Well, good evening. Ever so nice to see you all. Very nice to see you. It's been a while. Glad to see you, Forrest. And Jorge, two familiar faces come to see us. What a treat.
See you here.
So we're finishing up the Diamond Sutra tonight. And it's just the last two chapters. And the last chapter, according to Red Pine, is just Buddha's way of saying goodbye. And he gives us a little poem as his farewell, which is very sweet, because by that time the whole Subhuti has gotten the whole picture, and so there's nothing more to say. So if somebody wants to read chapter 31.
And how so? Subhuti, if someone should claim that the Tathagata speaks of a view of a self, or that the Tathagata speaks of a view of a being, a view of a life, or a view of a soul, Subhuti, would such a claim be true? Subhuti said, "No, indeed, Bhagavan. No, indeed, Subhuta. Such a claim would not be true, and why not? Bhagavan, when the Tathagata speaks of a view of a self, the Tathagata speaks of it as no view. Thus it is called a view of a self." The Buddha said, "Indeed, Subhuti, so it is. Those who set forth on the Bodhisattva path know, see, and believe all dharmas, but know, see, and believe them without being attached to the perception of a dharma. And why not? The perception of a dharma, Subhuti, the perception of a dharma is said by the Tathagata to be no perception. Thus it is called the perception of a dharma."
So these are the four views of the self that Buddha talked about in the very beginning. The view of a self, a being, a life, or a soul. Each one of those is a mistaken view, and a view that confuses us because we become attached to the idea that there is such a thing. And that's why when we talk about we should get rid of the ego. In a way, it's ludicrous because there's no ego to get rid of. And so it's the attachment that to an idea as if it were real. Attachment to a thought as if it had substance. And yet you can't feel it, touch it, see it, taste it. When you look for the self, or the ego, or the soul, or any of those, or even the reality of the table, or the beautiful flowers, they're an illusion. They're real in a sense that we're experiencing them. So it's not that it's some sort of woo-woo land, but that if we think they have any substance at all, we're mistaken. So, Chao Ming gave it a title, of course, and his title is Not Giving Birth to Concepts or Views. So it's not about things, it's about ideas. Giving birth to ideas to which we become attached. and to say, it's real, I know it is. It's heavy, I can measure it. I know how many atoms is in it, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, the reality is just based on our way of perceiving, of which we, at this point, still know very little. We then said, the Tathagata speaks this sutra so that all beings will themselves realize the wisdom of prajna and themselves cultivate the fruit of enlightenment. Foolish people don't understand the Buddha's meaning and think the Tathagata is talking about the view of a self or a soul, unaware that the Tathagata is teaching the profound, formless, conditionless paramita of prajna. When the Tathagata talks about the view of a self or a soul, it isn't the same as the views that foolish people have of a self or a soul. The Tathagata says that all beings have the Buddha nature. This is the view of a true self. And he says that all beings possess wisdom uncontaminated by passion and a nature that is already complete. This is the view of a soul. He says that all beings are themselves already free of affliction. This is the view of a being. And he says that the nature all beings possess is neither created nor destroyed. This is his view of a life. So I want to share something with you that just showed up in the latest science news. It's called Self as Symbol. It's an article by Tom Siegfried based on a book that's been published by Hofstadter. It goes like this. Consciousness is more than just an ordinary feedback loop. It's a strange loop, which Hofstadter describes as a loop capable of perceiving patterns in its environment and assigning common symbolic meanings to sufficiently similar patterns. A human brain, though, can assign symbols to patterns. While patterns of dots on a TV screen are just dots to a mosquito, to a person, the same dots evoke symbols, such as football players, talk show hosts, or NCIS agents. Floods of raw sensory data trigger perceptions that fall into categories designated by symbols that stand for abstract regularities in the world, Hofstadter asserts. Human brains create vast repertoires of these symbols, conferring the power to represent phenomena of unlimited complexity and thus to twist back and to engulf themselves via a strange loop. Consciousness itself occurs when a system with such ability creates a higher level symbol, a symbol for the ability to create symbols. That symbol is the self, the I, consciousness. You and I are mirages that perceive themselves, Hofstadter writes. This self-generated symbol of the self operates only on the level of symbols. It has no access to the workings of nerve cells and neurotransmitters, the microscopic electrochemical machinery of neurobiological life. The symbols that consciousness contemplates don't look much like the real thing, the way a map of Texas conveys nothing of the grass and dirt and asphalt and bricks that cover the physical territory. And just like a map of Texas remains remarkably stable over many decades, it doesn't change with each new pothole in a Dallas street. Human self-identity remains stable over a lifetime, despite constant changes on the micro level of proteins and cells. As an individual grows, matures, changes in many minute ways, the conscious self's identity remains intact, just as Texas remains Texas, even as new skyscrapers rise in the cities, farms grow different crops, and the Red River sometimes shifts the boundary with Oklahoma a bit. If consciousness were merely a map, a convenient shortcut symbol for a complex mess of neurobiological signaling, perhaps it wouldn't be so hard to figure out. But its mysteries multiply because the symbol is generated by the thing doing the symbolizing. This self-referentialism creates unanswerable questions, unsolvable problems. He ends by saying, we draw conceptual boundaries around entities that we easily perceive. Easy to look at those beautiful flowers. We can see them so easy. And in so doing, we carve out what seems to us to be reality. Hofstadter wrote, the I we create for each of us is a quintessential example of such a perceived or invented reality. And it does such a good job of explaining our behavior that it becomes the hub around which the rest of the world seems to rotate. February 11th, 2012. I don't know whether he's read the Diamond Sutra or not, but he should read it if he hasn't. Thich Nhat Hanh says about this, all concepts co-arise and are empty of a separate self. If the highest, most fulfilled, awakened mind is empty, then the perceptions of self and so on are also empty. So why should we discriminate or be afraid of them? All concepts are dharmas, objects of mind, signs. Look deeply into one dharma, and you will see all dharmas. Once we understand that a concept is just a concept, we can go beyond that concept and be free of the dharma that concepts represent. Free of the attachment. So that if something happens that disabuses us of what we thought was true, we are free to change our mind, free to release the idea and accept another one, free to see through that idea and not be wedded to it in such a way that we're living in a dream of our ideas rather than being open to our experience. So this all goes back to the very original chapter where the first chapter where it just shows Buddha leading his ordinary life. Nothing special. He just got up and went to town and got some lunch, and then he came back and talked to his friends. It's not a fancy thing. It's just what it is, just as we are. But our ideas are so fascinating. They're so brilliant and they're so interesting, and we become so caught up by them, that we can't remember very easily. And that's what Buddha keeps pointing out to Subhuti. Just remember, these are ideas. This isn't the truth of it. This is just how we experience things at the moment. And of course, we do become attached in many different ways. But even in a deep, deep attachment, if we think, for instance, we're just going to be that our children will be around for us forever, then if something happens, something untoward happens to our child, it's inconceivable and unbearable, even though the truth of it is just what it is. That's why that story of the woman who lost her baby is so much about this very thing, that she couldn't believe that her baby had died because she was so attached to it, and she wanted Buddha to bring it back to life again. Until he had her experience how everybody suffers this kind of loss. And that if you're totally attached in the way that she was, then you suffer nothing but grief. And in our living in unreality, are living in a dream. The truth is, everything disappears and reappears in ways that we can't predict and we don't know. So, would somebody read the last chapter? Chapter 32. Thank you, Britt.
32. Furthermore, Subhuti, if a fearless bodhisattva filled measureless, infinite worlds with the seven gurus and gave them as an offering to the Tathagata, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones, a noble son or daughter grasped a single four-line gatha of this teaching on the perfection of wisdom, and memorized, discussed, recited, mastered, and explained it in detail to others. The body of merit produced by that noble son or daughter as a result would be immeasurably, infinitely greater. And how should they explain it? By not explaining. Thus is it called explaining. As a lamp, a cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning, you all created things like this. All this was spoken by the Buddha to the joy of the elder Subhuti, the monks and nuns, the laymen and laywomen, the bodhisattvas, the devas, humans, asuras, and gandharvas of the world, all of whom were greatly pleased with what the Buddha said.
Red Pine points out that women seem to have joined the group by the end of this thing, which he thought was a good thing. So, Chan-Ning calls this, apparitions are not real. The apparition of a bubble, it's real just for a second, and then it's something else. It isn't that it's nothing, but it's something else. So Riemann says, one thought of resolution and merit arrives just as fast. How can apparition bodies and illusory things suffice? When the true Buddha is everywhere, one's work is done. Thus follows a chapter on how apparitions are not real. And Te Ching says, Subhuti has already realized the totality of the Dharma body, but wonders that if it is not the Dharma body that speaks the Dharma, but the apparition body, then the Dharma spoken by the apparition body does not reach the state of the Dharma body. How then could someone who holds on to this Dharma obtain any merit? What follows explains that what is spoken by the apparition body is the true Dharma, because all three bodies are one and the same. Huineng said, speaking dharmas with skillful and expedient means, considering people's faculties and capacities and using whatever works. This is what is called explaining to others. Also, those who listen to dharmas exhibit many kinds of appearance. One must not discriminate, but simply maintain an utterly empty mind that accords with the truth. As to what accords with the truth and doesn't waver from it, no thought of attaining, no thought of gain or loss, no thought of the future, no thought of creating or destroying. Dreams are our false bodies. Illusions are our false thoughts. Bubbles are our afflictions. Shadows are our karmic obstructions. The karma of dreams, illusions, bubbles, and shadows are created dharmas. Uncreated dharmas are those that are real and free of name or appearance. Those who are enlightened are free of karma. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, being in touch with suchness is like digging a well and reaching the point where water forces its way up. Once we can drink directly from the well of understanding, we are no longer caught by the signs of a self, a person, a living being, or a lifespan. And maybe you know this. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the column-topped temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which inherit shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. That's Shakespeare's last speech in his last play, which was also his farewell, Prospero the magician. So, what to do? So, David Hodge says this, commit to living as if everything is always there forever, with the acceptance that nothing is going to survive. Other questions? Jeffrey?
Who was the author of his last remarks? I didn't catch it.
David Hodge. H-O-D-G-E. And I don't know where I found it. I'm not very...
A number of remarks, too, that I have no idea.
Yes.
My world, but...
It's embarrassing. Somebody wants to know.
So the, I guess the chapter before the last one, when we were just talking about the concepts of the self, am I interpreting like the comments and everything right, where it's not so much that he's talking about the concept of self so much as the concepts themselves, right? Or like the lack of, because some of the comments talked about how it wasn't so much about the concept of self or no self, but it was more of the concept or no concept. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Because I mean, he could have been talking about anything, right? He was talking about the actual concept that we have. Or the
exactly.
Conceptualization that we...
Except that we're in this weird loop where we have a concept, the concept about the concept is the self.
Right.
So it's even more complicated than the symbols that we carve out of the world and call a table. There's me who is doing that. So this is a sort of extra little thing that we are trying to figure out how we do that and what it means. And what he's saying is it's just as made up as carving out the table. That it's convenient, but it's only very, very tentatively true. Yeah.
I like how the scientist said it's an unsolvable problem. Like our consciousness is a problem.
Yeah.
It's unsolvable.
Well, they're working on it.
Figure us out.
They can't, they're totally bewildered. And so are we. I mean, if you really think about it, here we are looking out into this apparent world as apparent beings, and yet, What is it? And so if we begin to, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, really study even one thing deeply, we begin to appreciate how it is. It isn't just a thing anymore, that there's something to know and to be of and with that we can only understand if we can be willing to accept it. So it's really about acceptance. And the self notion gets in the way of acceptance. If there's me and you, then there's already this barrier. And it's only if we can drop the self and just be willing to accept what we're confronting that the truth comes. And the truth is that it's all Buddha nature. It's all what we call Buddha nature because we don't have any other name for it. And that too is just an extra name to put on something that we can't really, it's what I call the untalkaboutable. And yet we need to say something, and so we call it Buddha nature. Because it's something so deep and affects us so profoundly, if we're willing to open to it, that it creates our true identity of compassion, which has no name. It's just an action. It's how we enact life itself, or Buddha itself. Well, we're supposed to do something else next week. and I bet some of you have some ideas. I don't know. I'm open to practically anything.
I have a crazy thought.
Oh, good.
Maybe not. This is just blurt out what comes through our heads, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm just wondering if maybe next week, maybe or maybe not, you can talk about your experience with physical pain and going through what you went through. And did you ever imagine what that would be like and how sitting might have helped? Or just little things here and there that might help us when we go through.
When you go through it too.
We are.
You are, I know.
Just a thought. You guys think it's a crazy idea to put me down?
Well, I'd be glad to talk about it. Actually, the pain was before the surgery. You know, for a few years, the pain just got worse and worse and worse. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done the surgery. And as soon as I woke up, it was gone. So the real suffering, so-called, was before. But I'd be glad to talk about that, because it does take dealing with it. Both physically and psychically, you know, how to manage it. And we all have to manage, and I think we could all join in that conversation, because I'm sure we all have different ways. Yeah? Does that sound like a good idea? And then come up with a long-term thing or a longer-term thing next time?
I'm passing around that list.
Oh, thank you, Wendy. Yeah, I forgot about that. There's a lot of material out there. Too much. Maybe we should just sit every Tuesday night for the next... No, I didn't. Thank you. Well, these all sound good. Some of them we've done. And there's no reason not to do them again either.
Have you ever talked about the instructions to the Tenzin?
Yes, we have, but that's a marvelous one. Yeah, it's one of my favorites. Yeah, that's put that on the list. And Uchiyama Roshi has written a beautiful book about that. So that's a lovely one to study. Yeah. Well, we can take this home and think about it.